Let's get underway. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Parliamentary Library. My name is Jonathan Curtis. I'm the Assistant Secretary, Research Branch. And welcome to this morning's budget seminar. This is our traditional budget seminar, and this year it's the second of our two budget seminars. This morning's seminar has two parts. In the first part, Daniel Wright will explain how to read the budget papers, which, as anyone who's had a look at the enormous pile of them will know, is easier said than done. And there's a lot of hidden gems in there that I think come out in Daniel's presentation, things you may not ordinarily look at. In the second part, Dr. Nitin Gupta will provide a toolkit for a non-technical audience for interpreting and evaluating the budget. It's really proposing a set of questions, a way of interrogating a particular budget measure to sort of assess what's in it, what its strengths and weaknesses may be. So both speakers will go for approximately 20 minutes, and then we'll have question time at the end. So please join me in welcoming first Daniel.
Well, thank you very much for coming. I'm just going to have a start with a little overview of the Commonwealth's current fiscal position and essentially where we're at. The information that I'm using here on the first slide is actually taken from the mid-year economic and fiscal outlook document that was released in December. So for most of this budget material, what you're comparing it to is not last year's budget. You're actually going back to the mid-year economic and fiscal update report, which is the latest budget release from the Commonwealth. This chart here shows the budget surplus or deficit of the Commonwealth since 1996-97. You can see that we were basically in surplus up until the global financial crisis, and then we've been in persistent deficits since that time. You'll notice here that there are actually three lines. There's not just one line, there are three lines. There's an underlying cash balance line, a fiscal balance line, and a net operating balance line. We'll get back to talking about those in a moment, but I think the best thing to take out from this is all three of these lines roughly track in the same way. There's not a huge difference between those three different measures. Okay. And this is a chart which shows, and debt has been a persistent issue in the political debate over the years. This shows Australia's net debt, so that's our gross debt minus our financial sort of liquid assets. And it shows Australia's net debt compared to other developed, advanced economies. Australia's right down here at the bottom. We have very low net debt, which is probably a pretty good thing, but it's nonetheless been a persistent issue. There is, a question about whether or not it's appropriate to compare Australia, which is a resource-intensive economy with a significant agricultural sector, whether it's appropriate to compare Australia's economic situation to, say, Germany, which is in the centre of Europe, it has a much larger manufacturing sector. It's not as simple as simply saying we have a very low net debt. You do have to sort of unpack that. But debt has been a persistent issue. I'm not going to spend a long time on charts and graphs of economic data because all this will be out of date at 7:30 tonight when the government releases its budget. There'll be a new set of economic parameters, a new set of economic forecasts that you really need to turn your mind to. Okay, now I'm just going to go through some really important budgetary concepts. Now, at the centre of the budget is the Consolidated Revenue Fund, which is established in Section 81 of the Constitution, and the budget each year is an appropriation from the Consolidated Revenue Fund. It's where the executive government comes to the Parliament and asks for the Parliament to pass a law, pass an appropriation bill to release money to the executive government. So obviously very little can happen unless the Parliament approves the release of that money. I'm not going to talk a great deal about the way in which these appropriation bills are dealt with by the Parliament because the House of Representatives are 12 15 in the Federation Chamber has another seminar where they talk about the passage of the budget bill, the bills through the Parliament. So that's very worth attending if you're interested in that. But when the Treasurer gets up at 7:30 at night and starts his speech, he's actually talking, he's providing a second reading speech on an appropriation bill, appropriation bill number one for 2017-18, it will be this year. There are usually three appropriation bills, an appropriation bill number one and two, which for constitutional reasons have slightly different things in them, an appropriation bill for the Parliament because the Parliament is not part of the government, so it's dealt with separately. Now, these annual appropriation bills provide for around 15% of the expenditure of the Commonwealth each year. There is another type of appropriation which is incredibly important, and it's called a special appropriation. When the Parliament or the government establishes large expenditure programs such as Social Security, Medicare, or establishes a debt market for the Commonwealth and needs to be able to pay interest on the Commonwealth's debt, it will often establish a special appropriation. And this special appropriation is indefinite approval by the Parliament for the release of money in relation to a specific program when certain criteria are met. Often the government, if it wants to control the amount of money which comes out via these special appropriations, it needs to go back into the enabling legislation, for example, the Social Security Act, and actually change the criteria under which money is allowed to be spent. Okay, now there are a couple of different accounting methods that are used in the Commonwealth budget. There is cash accounting over this side, which records, in simple terms, cash when it's received and records cash when it exits the Commonwealth. A very simple concept, cash coming in, cash going out. There is another approach to accounting, which is called accrual accounting, which records not cash when it's received, but revenue when it is earned. So it matches the recognition of the earning of revenue to the time the economic event occurs. So sometimes you'll have a lag between when a particular economic transaction occurs and when the money turns up in relation to that. You also have some expenses under accrual accounting which don't have any cash attached to them at all. For example, a government building wearing out, that will result in some depreciation. There's no cash payment there, but it's still an expense for the Commonwealth. Now, there has been a suggestion in the media recently that the government will move from its current headline measure of the budget surplus deficit position, which is the underlying cash balance, which is net cash flows from just ordinary operating activities, plus basically its capital purchases, which gives you the underlying cash balance. There's a suggestion that it will move from this measure and not to this fiscal balance measure over here, which is roughly an equivalent accrual measure, but it will move up to this operating balance measure. Okay. Now, this will possibly mean it's easier to demonstrate a surplus position because you won't be including those transactions in relation to capital purchases. This possibly sounds somewhat radical, and it's been presented in the media in some places as a sort of a tweak of accounting rules or something like that. I'll just show you how radical this is. If we look at the headline budget balance used by all the other jurisdictions in Australia, basically they all use net operating balance. So it certainly would be a big change if the government moved to this new measure, and what I suspect they'll do is not move to it entirely, but they'll emphasise it a lot more. But if they do start emphasising it a lot more, it's not entirely unprecedented. In fact, it's the common practice amongst jurisdictions in Australia. Okay. Now, when we're talking about the government's budget, typically we are talking actually about a reasonably narrow subset of Commonwealth activity. When someone says the deficit or surplus is this, what they're generally talking about is this sector here, the general government sector, which includes government departments, government agencies, you know, the federal court, all those types of entities, all those things that you associate with the government. typically governmental activities. It doesn't include public non-financial corporations, and this is government-owned entities which undertake really a commercial activity. So over here we have the NBN Co, and possibly we may have in this budget new entities being established to deliver, for example, infrastructure. It also doesn't include public financial corporations over here. There's been a suggestion that there might be a housing financing fund established. If they did establish it in this budget, if they did establish a housing finance fund, it's likely to be a public financial corporations sector entity, which means it won't be directly included in the budget surplus deficit position. So in this year's budget, possibly with some more infrastructure spending via maybe a special company or possibly a bond aggregator in the housing market, it's likely that there'll be some things which the government announces which don't directly impact on the general government sector. Okay, now, in addition to that split in the budget numbers, there's also another split which is very important. The budget papers typically differentiate between what they call administered monies and programs and assets at times, and departmental monies, programs and assets. Now, an administered program is something which a government department does on behalf of the Commonwealth as a whole. So the Department of Social Security or Human Services that makes welfare payments, they are doing that on behalf of the Commonwealth, and they have to essentially do it the way the Commonwealth is directing them to. There is no discretion. They can't choose who gets a welfare payment or not. They simply have to administer the payments. Likewise, the tax office collects revenue, but it doesn't collect it for itself. It can't just simply go and spend that money. It collects it on behalf of the Commonwealth according to the tax laws and transfers it straight to the Treasury. Very little discretion there. But this administered stuff is generally what's referred to as sort of program money. So if you're interested in how much the government is spending on social security or the environment or healthcare, generally the amount spent on the programs is administered. Now, departmental money is money which government departments and agencies have a high degree of discretion over how they're able to spend it. So departments will receive a particular amount of money. They might be able to spend it on salaries and wages for staff, or they may be able to get a consultant in to do that similar activity. Office supplies, whether or not they rent a building in one part of Canberra or another part of Canberra, they have a choice and a discretion about how they spend that money. Departmental money, that question, has the government cut the public service? You'd sort of be looking at departmental money to see whether or not sort of public servants at the number of public service servants or the capacity of the public service is being reduced. A further distinction that runs all through the budget papers is a distinction between policy decisions of the government and what's generally called parameter variations, things which are outside the budget, outside the control of the government. Now, policy decisions, and there's an entire volume of the budget papers that looks at policy decisions. Policy decisions are within the control of the government. They either choose or not, choose to spend more money or cut spending in a particular area. They have pretty much direct control over that. Now, parameter variations are things which flow through the budget numbers for reasons that are beyond the control of the Commonwealth directly. For example, corporate profits. If corporations have a very poor few years, don't make great profits, company tax receipts are likely to be a lot lower. That will impact the Commonwealth's finances. There are also other kinds of things that will impact in a longer term way the finances of the Commonwealth. For example, an ageing population, higher cost, better quality medical interventions are likely to, over time, increase the cost of Medicare. And in every budget, there is a balance between the policy decisions of the government tending to try and counteract some of these parameter variations. And one final concept. There is, in the budget, most programs are delivered through simple government funding, so you can find the amount of funding and it'll be attached to a particular program. That's reasonably clear. There are some programs and activities the government undertakes which are provided for by a special account. Now, a special account is a situation where the Commonwealth says, for a particular activity where you want to allocate a certain amount of money, maybe $2 billion, and they set it aside and in a special account, and then they spend that money over a period of time. And we'll get back to this in a minute. But some programs, for example, water buybacks in the environment portfolio, are provided for by these special accounts where previous governments or the current government sets aside a significant amount of money for those. Okay. We'll just go straight to the budget papers. I'll just show you a couple of ones here which I won't talk about in great detail. The appropriation bills. The covers look like most other bills. The first few pages are quite technically straightforward, but after that you just have page after page after page of schedules of financial information. They're incredibly necessary in a parliamentary sense, but in terms of a light and easy read, they are almost impossible to comprehend. So, absolutely necessary to have an appropriation bill going through the parliament, but really to interpret these, you really need to go to some of the other materials. I said that the Treasurer's speech at 7:30 is the second reading speech on appropriation bill number one. Each year, the government produces a copy of the second reading speech and includes it with the budget materials. This is very much the Treasurer's statement as to why the budget should be passed, in his view. Okay. There's also another document which comes out every year, and it's called the Budget Overview, but it's generally referred to sometimes as the glossy. This is a really very high-level overview of the budget for a given year, and it's essentially prepared by the government to emphasise the things which the government, you know, the kind of impression that the government wants to give you in relation to the budget in the given year. All the information in here is accurate, but it's possibly not the complete picture, and you do probably need to go to some of the more detailed papers to get a better sense of the budget. Okay. And if the government wants to talk about a particular issue or emphasise a particular issue in a given year, it might release a ministerial statement. This pulls together information across a whole range of different areas and brings it into one statement. Again, it's very much an exercise in the government telling the parliament and the public more generally about all the good things it's doing. This one last year was in relation to regional development, but again, it has some limits because I think it's within the discretion of the government what goes into these documents, which ones are produced, which ones aren't produced in a given year. Okay, we'll go on to the main budget papers now. Okay, budget paper number one. This is really the economic financial overview document. This is the kind of document that if you're an economist in a bank in Sydney, this is probably the first document that you would go to. It includes all their economic forecasts, Treasury's economic forecasts for the international or for other countries, revenue forecasts, economic parameters. It's that kind of material in there. It does include some interesting information. They've started to include what they call now a debt statement. It's in statement number 6 in budget paper number 1. There has been a suggestion this year that there will be some distinction drawn between good debt and bad debt. Now, we've talked amongst ourselves and we're not totally clear how they're going to do that. But if they do do that, it's most likely to appear or be explained in detail in statement number 6 of budget paper number 1. There's also a very useful document or statement in budget paper number 1 called statement 10, which is historical Australian government data. Now, you'll often hear commentators coming out after the budget and saying, this is the highest taxing government in 23 years, or the lowest taxing government, or, you know, we have the fastest, increase in this or that. What the commentators have often done is they've simply gone to this summary data in statement number 10 of budget paper number 1, which generally goes back to 1970, 1971, and provides very long-term overview of the high-level information in relation to the Commonwealth's finances. So, a very useful document. Now, we'll go over to budget paper number 2. Now, budget paper number 2, I was talking about policies and decisions previously. Budget paper number 2 is basically every policy decision of the government in the current budget. It's divided into revenue measures, expense measures and capital measures. So if the government has essentially made a decision in relation to pretty much any topic, it should be in here. This is very much the document that if you worked in a stakeholder group, you work for an aged care organisation and you think, what's in it for aged care? You go here, if there is an announcement there in relation to aged care, you can say, well, that's what the government's doing in relation to aged care. If there's nothing in there, you probably, you can probably infer, well, the government's not done anything on aged care. So this is sort of the what's in this budget this year in relation to the topics and areas that I'm interested in. Within all these subheadings, it's organised under portfolio. So you do need to have a sense of which portfolio the particular issues that you're interested in are likely to fall. Now, the third document, the third budget paper, is probably one of the more underrated budget papers. This is called Federal Financial Relations. This details all the financial transactions between the Commonwealth and the states in a given year, or the budgeted transactions. Now, last year, or this year, this current year, the government has budgeted to spend roughly $450 billion in total. The grants to the states that it will make are roughly $115 billion of that. So an incredibly significant amount of money goes out to the states and territories. About $60 billion of that is the GST revenue, and there are issues around the GST at the moment, but we won't go there. But there's another sort of $55 billion or so a year that goes on health, education, disability services, all these types of things. If you're interested in, for example, healthcare, and you simply go and look at the health portfolio, you're possibly missing a very significant amount of funding that's going through to the states for healthcare. So this is a very important document if you want to get a sense of the total level of activity of the Commonwealth in relation to some of these policy areas. And the final budget paper is budget paper number 4. Now, this is actually a very difficult budget paper to deal with. It just contains a huge amount of very technical information. I would suggest that if you don't know what you're looking for, you almost need to know what you're looking for before you go to this budget paper. It doesn't really, it's a very difficult budget paper to navigate. But I spoke earlier about special accounts and how some programs are delivered through special accounts. Budget paper number 4, for example, tells you explicitly how much will be in a special account at the start of a year, how much additional will go in, how much will come out, and what the balance at the end of the year will be. So if you're interested in the program and you know that it's delivered through a special account, go to budget paper number 4, and it should have really quite precise information there. Okay. Now, then we get to the portfolio budget statements, and I think maybe most people will have seen at least one or two of these. I didn't bring them all. I think there's one for every portfolio, obviously, which I think runs to about 26 portfolios at the moment. So there are a huge number of portfolio budget statements. These have very fine detail about the activities of each individual entity within each individual portfolio. It has the total resources that are available to that entity. The budget measures that were announced in budget paper number 2, it will say which portfolio it affects or which agency it affects, but it won't give you much fine detail about how it affects that agency. The portfolio budget statements have a reconciliation in there that shows precisely which programs, which activities are affected and by how much. So you should be able to trace from budget paper number 2 through to the portfolio budget statement of an affected agency what the impact of that measure is. It has financial statements, so if you want to know whether their funding's gone up or down or they've got more or less departmental funding in a given year, you should be able to find that in the portfolio budget statement of that agency. Then it has information about the individual outcomes and programs that the agency is intending to deliver for the Commonwealth in a given year. Now, an outcome, the Commonwealth doesn't just give agencies money, it gives agencies money to achieve certain outcomes. And agencies adopt at least one, but possibly 2 or 3 or 4 programs to contribute to that outcome. So each outcome will have a description of what it's seeking to achieve. It will have some performance criteria about, you know, in the government's view, if, you know, certain targets are met, this program is successful. If they're not met, then that's a problem. It'll have quite precise information about how much is going to be spent on each individual outcome and program. So in a department, for example, like Social Security, that runs an entire, or Human Services, I think, that runs a huge number of welfare programs and other types of programs, the portfolio budget statement can narrow your focus down to an individual welfare program or an individual area of activity. So it might simply be support for students or support for aged people. So it gives you very good fine level data. Okay, and that's where I'll stop. So thank you.
We'll now move to part 2 of the seminar with Dr. Nitin Gupta.
Thank you, Jonathan, and thanks, Daniel. So Daniel's presentation focused on the budget papers themselves, where to access them, how to read through them, and so forth. This part of the presentation focuses on basically a simple toolkit, a series of fundamental questions and concepts that will help you to interrogate particular measures. And I'm very mindful that the audience here is coming from a wide range of portfolio areas, whether it's, you know, climate policy or infrastructure or social policy or whatever. So the intention really is to have a framework that can be applied to any type of budget measure, or most types of budget measures, and most types of portfolio areas. And when I say that it's fundamental, again, following on from what Daniel was saying, it's not going to become outdated at 7:30 tonight. And my presentation, the stuff I'm going to speak about, it's reflecting a very non-partisan intent. So it's not criticizing or favoring any side of politics. It's just a series of economic concepts. Now, budgets basically are a very peculiar and a very particular type of document. There's a big emphasis and there's a big attention given to the release of budgets, but it's really just a statement of intentions and priorities of what the government wants to do over the coming year and what kind of money it wants to allocate over the next sort of forward estimates, forward period. So it's really all about revenues and expenditure. It's articulating taxes, it's articulating the grants and incentives it wants to give to various economic players. And as such, it's just a tool of fiscal policy. It's one of the levers that influence outcomes in an economy. The others obviously being things like monetary policy, trade policy, exchange rates and interest rates that either get set overseas in the external environment or are influenced by them. And again, as we saw earlier, about 85% of funds are already allocated and committed in budgets. So budgets really reflect very small changes. So even in particular measures, you might have a small or a medium increase or a decrease, or even for new measures that are introduced, it might have relatively smaller funds compared to the total amount. All budgets make assumptions about projections, and that's important. In an uncertain environment, you have to make assumptions. You cannot navigate uncertainty without some assumptions. But very often, the assumptions themselves remain implicit, unquestioned. So it's important to be able to think about what assumptions are being made and whether they are correct or valid, and over what time frame. Then there is this thing about government versus market. Depending on whichever side of politics the comments come from, one will say the governments need to do this, otherwise the vulnerable sections are going to lose out. The others say, no, let the market handle it. Markets are efficient, they have the best information, they can do it. And really, if you look at budget measures across the years, there is this swinging of the pendulum that you can see. It's an ideological spectrum, basically. But what budgets really do is they provide information, they allocate resources, and they create expectations and rules. So it's important to keep that context in mind. And so with that, with all these truths about the budget, we come to a series of questions which I think anybody can take to particular budget measures. Things like, how well understood is the problem? How will success be measured? Should the government be doing this? What will the reaction be? How effective will it be? And where does the buck stop? Now, these are obvious enough questions, but what I've tried to do is draw insights from a wide range of economic subsections and areas to inform these questions. So if you look at, for example, how well understood is the problem? There are many social problems that are plagued by information issues. And that's because they cannot be directly observed or measured. Things like a person's state of mind, the level of abuse or violence in society, what is a person's innate talent, the level of addiction, these are not directly measured. So one of the first things when you're looking at a particular budget measure, it's important to ask what kind of measure is being used to illustrate or inform the issue in question. Is it a direct measure? Something that can actually be measured, or is it an indirect measure? Something that's what in economic parlance might be called a proxy. The next thing is, well, how well do they reflect the problem? Is it a partial or an incomplete reflection of the extent of the problem? Or is there something of a possibility of misrepresentation or misunderstanding? So it's worth interrogating. And this is important because sometimes if a problem is not observed, it's not measured, it may not even be considered a problem. And the reason I say that is, till a few decades ago, there were quite a few things, again, mental health issues, violence, gender discrimination in the workplace, obesity, these are sorts of things that were not even considered as problems till a few decades ago. So it's only over time when more and more data, and one of the reasons they were not seen as problems is because there was no data collected on these things. So there was a bit of a vicious cycle. There was no data to inform the problem, and therefore it was not seen as a problem, and therefore not addressed. Over time, a lot of resources and effort has been spent trying to collect and improve data relating to these things. So as more and more data gets collected, the extent of the problem becomes evident, and therefore that creates the incentive and the interest in addressing that through policy. So what was a vicious cycle then can become a virtuous cycle. Another policy implication is, given that governments have very limited amounts of funds available, it's important to allocate them in a most sort of effective way, to get the best bang for the buck. And the analogy used is the fence or the ambulance. So if there's a cliff, and it's known that there's a risk of people falling over, what do? Do you put a fence around it to stop people from falling over, or do you have an ambulance to get them to the hospital? Basically, it's, you know, are you going for a preventative or a remedial course of action? So understanding the nature of the problem is important. The other question then becomes important is, if you're targeting a particular indirect variable, a proxy, will it actually address the underlying problem, the unobserved problem? So if a proxy for mental health or violence is the number of calls that are made to a particular helpline. And you monitor, because you cannot very often directly measure mental health, but you say how many calls are coming into the helpline. Over time, if the number of calls reduce, is it that the extent of the problem has actually gone down, or is it that it's been reported less? These are the sorts of things looking at particular budget measures need to be thought about. And it's important because there are many problems like bankruptcies and foreclosures and stock market volatility for which you have extensive real-time data. You can actually measure how things are performing in real-time and which are direct measures. So on one hand, you have this situation where problems may not be directly observable, but the other side of that, the flip side of that is that there are many concepts that you will find in everyday parlance, which actually are very technical terms that come from economics, but they're either not they're not fully understood or they're misapplied. Common terms are innovation, efficiency, productivity. They're used synonymously, but they're not synonymous. And they have very technical guidelines in terms of how they should be defined and how they should be measured, and therefore how they should be used. So when you're looking at particular budget measures, you come across these terms that are taken for granted and accepted without questioning. It's important to maintain a little bit of a critical attitude. For example, if you're talking about efficiency, are you talking about what does it really mean? Is it improved processes and products? Is it a better way of doing things? Or is it reducing wastage? What does it really mean? Take it down one level further. If you're looking at improved outcomes, are you looking at increased output per unit cost, which is a common measure of efficiency, or is it simply cost cutting? Reducing wastage is good, but cost cutting might have long-term adverse effects. For example, again, if you have the issue of infrastructure, which has been in the news lately, and you're looking at developing new roads, you know, there's a problem of traffic congestion, for example, and you develop new roads, or you have new, better forms of monitoring traffic, or imposing charges on drivers to divert traffic away from peak time towards non-peak times, then that might actually improve processes. On the other hand, if cost cutting leads to compromised road maintenance, then you're going to have a problem in the long run, including maybe having to spend more money later on to fix it. Another question that you can use to interrogate the budget is, should the government actually be doing this? You know, is it something best left for the private markets? And that's important because very often, and economists understand this, that markets are not efficient. Markets are not fully free, and they don't have the best information. There's often market failure. So the question to really ask is there a market failure? And if yes, there may be a case for government intervention. Look at the question of externalities. It's a technical term, it's a jargon term, but all it means is when private actions will have social consequences. Your own actions, the actions of individual companies, affect others. Positive externalities are things like research, which increase the body of knowledge in society and therefore has a positive impact on society. Negative externality is when private actions like noise or environmental pollution cause social harm. So in looking at whether the government should be doing this, the question is, what happens if the government doesn't do this? According to economic theory, if the government does not intervene in situations of externality, then there's going to be an underproduction of good things and an overproduction of bad things. Either way, society loses. Society is worse off. So, common examples that you might encounter in budgets across the years, there might be funds for renewable energy subsidies that government gives out. There might be various types of technical feasibility studies for developing new resource sites. Should the government be doing this? Well, think about it. A lot of these activities are very expensive, and they are prone to a lot of very high level of risk. So if corporations were doing it themselves, you know, they face the prospect of very heavy financial losses. They will not do this unless they have some sort of subsidy or some sort of guarantee. And if they don't do it, society is worse off. So by subsidizing the cost of some of these things, by getting involved, the government is sharing the burden, but also it allows, by being a sort of relevant invested stakeholder, the government is able to safeguard public interest. It helps to balance efficiency, profitability, and sustainability. So again, when I use the example of research and environmental pollution, look at the case of CSIRO in Australia. It does a lot of fundamental research, which then gets commercialized or quantified, which has a benefit for society. The best example in CSIRO's context is that of Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi was developed by CSIRO, but now it's adopted the world over, and CSIRO gets regular royalties on that. Negative externality, the best example comes from the United States. In the 1970s, the US waterways and rivers were so badly polluted, they would actually catch fire. That's the amount of pollution that was being thrown by industrial plants into the waterways. So the US stepped in, the government stepped in, and in the 1970s created the Environmental Protection Agency. So they were addressing a kind of negative externality, which over time, over the decades, has done a significant, had a significant impact in terms of improving environmental performance. The next question to ask is, what will the reaction be? And as we saw, fiscal policy is just one of the levers. Government has to interact with a wide range of stakeholders who may like particular policies, who may not like particular policies. They may have promoted or lobbied for some or lobbied against others. So it's important to consider, when you're looking at particular measures, what the reactions are going to be. Who are the winners and losers? Who faces greater and more immediate measurable impact? And as we will see later on, that's easier said than done. Measuring impact is a very hard thing. The second thing to ask is, yes, who are the winners and losers? But the second thing is, what incentives and resources do they have? Because this is going to inform how likely they are to organize, formally organize into groups of supporters or opponents. And that is really where rhetoric translates into action. So in terms of reactions, you can have expected reactions. You may have unexpected reactions. With expected reactions, the tobacco plain packaging law that was passed a few years ago illustrates whether you're going to have, you know, effective mobilization or apathy. The tobacco companies, and there are only a handful of them around the world, they're multi-billion dollar corporations. So they did not like the plain packaging laws, and they opposed it very aggressively. And it's reasonable. I mean, in plain packaging, because of plain packaging in Australia itself, they would have lost probably hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. But there's a bigger problem of precedent, where if other countries see what's going on and they impose similar laws and restrictions on tobacco companies, their global revenues are going to get affected. So they mobilized, they expectedly mobilized against the law and sued the Australian government using intellectual property provisions in the World Trade Organization. On the other hand, you would expect that the people who would benefit from this, the general population, would speak up about it, but they didn't. Because the marginal, the individual gains to any of them would be so small, they didn't have the incentive to organize into effective support base for the law. So in that case, the government sort of anticipated, I suppose, and acted as a champion for the winners. The government is taking the fight to the tobacco companies, if you like. And this is, again, across the political spectrum. So those are expected reactions. There are also unexpected reactions, which really you think, look before you leap. For example, if the government has a provision that provides incentives or some kind of safety net, you know, could be unemployment insurance, could be funding for childcare, could be some kind of regulation for improving traffic safety, vehicle safety, there's a problem, what's called moral hazard, that the people who are beneficiaries of particular policies actually end up acting in ways that counteract the intention of the policy. So if I have insurance, or if I'm a bank and I have the government as a lender of last resort, the Reserve Bank, I'm likely to take more risk as a result because I know somebody else is there to clean up the mess. So when you're thinking of reactions, think about whether it creates some kind of perverse incentives. Another reaction that you might not expect comes from basically this insight that a sense of loss is more acute than an equivalent sense of gain. So if I give you $100, the pleasure you will feel at that is a lot less than the pain you will feel if I take that $100 back. So it's one of the most powerful insights from behavioral economics. And when you're thinking about particular policies, think about whether this sort of dynamic is happening. Whether people's reactions are going to be different depending on whether you're giving or taking away stuff. finally, you might have reactions coming from people who are not affected directly. So consider the case of automobile industry support. The automobile plants shut down, and the government gave a lot of support to sort of help the industry transition away. But what you then ended up what ended up happening was that other industries who saw the benefits that were going to one industry, those industries started lobbying for similar benefits. So different groups might try to buy in. They might try to spend their own money and lobbying efforts to get similar benefits. So those are the sorts of reactions that often are not anticipated or expected, but they can happen as well. The next question really is, how effective will it be? And if the government is spending money, limited resources, that's a fundamental question to ask. And really the thing to ask is, will the net result be positive? When you're looking at particular budget measures, think about whether any conclusive or time-specific statements are being made about the results or benefit. This policy will have so much benefit over the next 5 or 10 years, whatever it is. It's important to maintain a critical approach, because using cost-benefit analysis, we see that costs are often underestimated and benefits are going to be overestimated. So one has to maintain a bit of a critical attitude. Costs are immediate. The moment you spend money or you commit money, that's done. Benefits often come with a lag. And sometimes the lag can be quite a lot. And it's also, I should add, sometimes when the benefit comes with a lag and another government is from another political spectrum is going to gain the benefit, the possibility of doing that reduces. Costs are fixed and benefits are uncertain. And that's important because benefits are hard to measure, as I mentioned earlier. There's a lot of stuff we hear about industrial or innovation investments. Again, different parties want to make investments in innovation. And the logic is to help the economy transition away from a resource-based economy. But when I say benefits are uncertain, what are the sorts of issues that arise? What is the state of technology? If the government invests in a particular type of technology and the technology becomes obsolete in a short period of time, then all the money is going to get wasted. Think of 5 minutes, okay. Now, if the government of Finland was investing in telephones, mobile phones in the early part of last decade, and it was investing a lot of money, or the government of Japan was investing in particular types of music or CD technology, well, both became obsolete when the iPhones came in. Then there's what's called the 1-10-100 rule. You can think about it like this. It takes $1 to develop a technology, it takes $10 to convert that into a marketable product, and it takes $100 to successfully commercialize that. So if you're seeing budget measures where a certain amount of money is being spent to help commercialize things, and that money looks like a lot, think about it may not actually be a lot, because that's the amount of money it actually takes to commercialize, and it might actually be less than what's needed. The third is global competition. So just because you can make something doesn't mean you can sell it. If you can make something, there are lots of other companies and countries around the world that can make the same thing. And they might be better resourced and better funded, and they might be able to put up a more aggressive competition in order to sell their goods. So just being able to make something doesn't mean you can sell it, and that's important to remember. And sometimes governments give particular incentives and grants, but the conditions might be so onerous that people or organizations or companies don't take it up. So there's a problem of responsiveness. Will this actually get taken up? Will people respond positively to it? Is something to think about. And finally, the last question to ask is, where does the buck stop? There are many problems that governments have to deal with which are very complex and which don't have clear lines of accountability. One of them, for example, is combating financial fraud and misconduct. It's a very complex problem. And even if you leave aside external stakeholders within the government itself, look at the number of stakeholders there are. The Treasury develops the taxation and economic policies. Australian Securities and Investment Commission is a corporate regulator. It regulates corporations. Australian Prudential and Regulatory Authority regulates the financial sector. ATO collects the taxes. And on top of this, the government rules have to very often conform to multilateral taxation treaties. So it's very, in complex problems, it's very easy to pass the buck and blame the other side, somebody else. And very often there, these organizations are working at cross purposes to each other. So when you're thinking in terms of accountability, think in terms of, are the incentives, expectations, and cultures consistent across various stakeholders? And what will it take to get that consistency going? Do various stakeholders have clear lines of authority and accountability? Who makes the decision and who bears the blame? Or who faces responsibility? And that's important because a lot of these agencies come for Senate estimates and they have to answer questions. And it's important that these things are understood and articulated beforehand. There might be conflicts of interest. Now again, in the US example, we've seen that after the 2008 financial crisis, a lot of rules were put into place to prevent the kind of abuse that led to the crisis in the first place. Now what you have in the Trump administration is a lot of people from Wall Street are coming in and taking charge of the regulatory agencies. So the people who are supposed to be regulating Wall Street have a direct vested interest in undermining or dismantling the laws that were put into place, like a fox guarding the hen. So one has to be careful. There are no conflicts of interest. And finally, in many cases, you have newer technologies and practices and processes that are coming on board. Case in point being financial sector, financial technology sector, where information technology is being used in very new ways, which the regulatory system is not geared up to deal with. The regulatory capacity is very often running a few steps behind the actual situation on the scene. So when you're talking about where does the buck stop, is the system geared up to deal with that? So to end again, we look at the questions again. When looking at any kind of budget measures, how well understood is the problem? How will success be measured? Should the government be doing this? What will be the reaction, the effectiveness, and who bears the responsibility? Thank you.
We have a couple of minutes. We have a couple of minutes for questions. If anyone has any questions for the presenters, and while you're thinking, I should actually move over here so that where I'm close to a mic. I'll just draw your attention to a couple of things. You'll see on your chairs the small flyer. This has a link to the Parliamentary Library's budget review homepage. So as we progressively publish a series of materials over the next few days for the rest of the week, they'll be progressively published onto that. The slides from today's seminar, as well as the slides from our three speakers yesterday, will also be published to that site, and as well as a few other useful, I hope, background papers like the one that's on your chair, which is a covers similar ground to Daniel's presentation, I think. So before I wrap up, were there any questions? Doesn't look like it. So
We're, if you have specific questions, we're more than happy, detailed questions, we're happy to, if you'd like to stay at the end, we're happy to do those, but...
Also, as a, and you remind me, as a general thing, we, our researchers are here to help, of course, so if once the budget is released, you'd like any assistance or advice on any of the budget measures or where to find things or how to interpret some of those budget measures or budget documents, give us a call. And you'll find the contacts also on the web page. Thank you very much for coming, and have an enjoyable budget week.